Now, I, Paul, myself urge you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. I will meet when face to face with you, but bold toward you when absent. What his enemies were saying. I ask that when I am present, I may not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against some who regard us as if we walked according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying, this is the apostolic we are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And we are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete. You are looking at things as they are outwardly. If anyone is confident in himself that he is Christ, let him consider this again within himself, that just as he is Christ, so also are we. For even if I should boast somewhat further about our authority, his apostolic authority, for which the Lord gave for building you up and not for destroying you, I shall not be put to shame. For do not wish to seem as if I would terrify you by my letters, for they say, his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech contemptible. Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when absent, such persons we are also indeed when present. For we are not bold to class or compare ourselves with some of those who commend themselves, but when they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they are without understanding. But we will not boast beyond our measure, but within the measure of the sphere which God apportioned to us as a measure to reach even as far as you. We are not overextending ourselves as if we did not reach to you, for we were the first to come even as far as you in the gospel of Christ. Not boasting beyond our measure, that is, in other men's labors, but with the hope that as your faith grows, we shall be within our sphere, enlarged even more by you, so as to preach the gospel even to the regions beyond you. Not to boast in what has been accomplished in the sphere of another. You boast, and boast in the Lord, for not he who commends himself is approved, but whom the Lord commends. Now, that is a long passage to read, and the title of this sermon is The Preacher Who Couldn't Preach. I hope you will not put in your notes after you finish that this was autobiographical. Now, as we look at this text in its context, the apostle has been discussing with the Corinthians their part in the offering that is being taken up in that part of the world for the victims of the famine in Jerusalem, talking about money. Serious, sober, dangerous business for a preacher to talk about. And he says, when he says in verse 1, now I, Paul, myself urge you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. This is the spirit in which I'm urging you to take up this offering. It reminds him, if I understand what's going on as this text moves along, it reminds him of one of the charges that has been laid against him. He's saying to them, now I'm not bossing you around in this thing. I am not saying to you that you have to do it or else. I'm urging you. I come to you in this matter of your giving in the same spirit that Christ comes to us, gently and meekly. And that's what I'm doing. Then he's reminded that this this persuading, gently commanding attitude that he has is the basis of one of the charges against him, which are being leveled against him in denial of his apostolic authority. And so it's as if he were saying, as I understand this, I'm urging you gently. Oh, yeah, remember, I'm the guy who, according to them, am meek when face to face, but bold when absent. And then he turns attention to answering this charge, which is only one of the charges which is leveled against him, as we are saying, which denied, leveled by those who are denying his apostolic authority. Because he was reminded of it because one of the things that was being said was this, that Paul is not an apostle, and his manner of preaching and teaching while he was here at Corinth proves it. Well, as we look at the general proposition in chapter 10, it can be summed up this way. He is answering his critics, turning his attention to them, being reminded of it, of this charge, by his statement that he is persuading them gently. He says about his critics that they are wrong. They do not understand his apostleship. They do not understand what's going on because they are measuring him by the wrong standard. Now that summarizes 2 Corinthians chapter 10. You got that? They have misunderstood his apostleship. This misunderstanding has led them to deny it. And the reason they misunderstood it is they were measuring his apostolic ministry in Corinth, his apostleship, by the wrong standard. And as he responds to this charge, this denial of his authority, we learn two basic things, and we're going to follow these as guidelines in our study of 2 Corinthians 10 this morning. In responding to this misunderstanding, which was created by their using the wrong standard, he gives us insight into two things. We're going to talk about these now. The character of apostolic preaching and the character of the apostolic preacher. They don't understand. I'm going to teach you, he says, the character of apostolic preaching. Secondly, the character of the apostolic preacher. Now we begin our text. First of all, and just summarizing ahead of time, what is the character of apostolic preaching? And I would word it this way, trying to capture the essence of this chapter. It is presenting Christ in truth. Presenting Christ in truth. You see, one of the reasons, as I have suggested, that Paul's apostolic ministry was questioned in the Corinth especially, not just in Corinth, was because of his gentle, persuading manner when he was with them. Which gentle persuasion he is using in regard to this money, which reminds him of it, as we've said. They were saying this, as I construct their argument from the inferences of Scripture, that Paul has no authority. And they give all kinds of reasons. He wasn't there with the original 12. And he came late. And he doesn't accept money like the others did, 1 Corinthians 9. And one of the reasons he's not an apostle is he has no authority because when he's in person, he is not authoritarian. He did not exercise his authority when he was here. Now, he's kind of a coward, you know. And when he gets at a safe distance and he writes to us, then he exercises his apostolic authority. If he were a real apostle, he would be the same when he's here as he was is when he writes. And we all know that when he was here, he was not wearing the mantle of one with divine authority. He was something else. And so that's what they were saying. Remember me, I'm the one, according to them, who's very meek when face to face, bold when I'm at a safe distance writing to you. Now, he denies that charge later on, but that's what was being said. Now, what were they saying? Well, down in verse 10, they say his letters are weighty and strong. He has apostolic authority when he writes. He's authoritarian. He has the spirit of authority. But his personal appearance is unimpressive and his speech contemptible. Preacher who couldn't preach. I mean, how can he be an apostle when he can't even preach? Now, what did they mean by contemptible? I suggest to you that we're not looking at the stumbling, empty ramblings of an ill-prepared ignoramus. They had a particular thing in mind when they said his speech is contemptible, that is, worthy to be rejected. They were basing it by the standard of the day of oratory. They, to sum it up, I would put it this way. They said Paul does not act like an apostle because of the complete absence of what I would call oratorical intimidation. Didn't talk that way. Now, you understand that in the first century, especially in the Gentile world, in the Roman world, the closer you got to Rome, the more you saw this, that oratory, public speaking, was considered the mistress of the arts. In fact, it's called that. Isn't that today? But it was then. Now, in the Roman curriculum of grammar, rhetoric, literature, philosophy, and oratory was the best. It superseded science, math, poetry in particular, literature in general, the art of getting up and speaking persuasively. Now, part of the reason for this was that in the traditional Roman system, in the good old days, a Roman citizen regularly had to argue for himself or for a cause, for a case, in the assemblies of the towns, within the political system, and in the courts. And a man who could not speak well and persuasively simply had a difficult time functioning in the business world, and certainly in the political world. Tacitus, reflecting back to the history of the first century, reflects back to the days of the Republic when it was truly the mistress of the arts, and he writes this in his Dialogue and Oratory. It was accordingly usual with our ancestors, when a lad was being prepared for public speaking, as soon as he was partially trained by home discipline and his mind was stored with culture, to have him taken by his father or his relatives to an orator who had a leading position in the state. The boy used to accompany and attend him and present and be present at all his public utterances, alike in the law court and the assembly, and thus he picked up the art of debate and became habituated to polemics, and indeed I may almost say learned how to fight a battle. Interesting metaphor. In the tradition, here's how we trained our boy, that they could win the battle of words. And then he adds this comment, because he's reflecting on how things used to be. Thus, from the beginning, they were imbued with true and genuine eloquence. But he's writing about the good old days, and things have changed in the first century. At the birth of the dictatorships, the assemblies were out of business. They did not argue for legislation as much because it was a dictatorship. And the arguing in courts was given over to the professionals, to the lawyers. And an oratory declined, and as historians put it, no one argued in the assemblies, only the professionals. And the training schools, listen to this, the oratorical training schools degenerated into rhetorical exercises divorced from reality. Remember that, divorced from reality. Attention was now fixed on style instead of content, the goal being artificial, superficial, epigrammatic brilliance. And Quintilian, who's the primary source for our understanding of education in the days of Jesus and the apostles, the first century, he writes about the state of the art, this mistress of the arts, in his day. The usual result of... this would be good stuff for a preaching class. Oh, listen to this. The usual result of overattention to the niceties of style is the deterioration of our eloquence. In our passion for words, we paraphrase what might be said in plain language, repeat what we have already said at sufficient length, pile up a number of words where one would suffice, and regard allusion as better than directness of speech. So, too, all directness of speech is at a discount. We think no phrase eloquent that another could conceivably have used. We borrow figures and metaphors from the most decadent poets and regard it as a real sign of genius that it should require genius to understand our meaning. Now, you see, this, if I understand what's going on here, this was the standard that was applied to Paul. When they said his speech is contemptible, I believe that they meant contemptible not in terms of content, but in terms of oratorical style. One of Paul's problems was that he said exactly what he meant. And he said it directly. And he did not do it according to the extravagant, artificial world of unreality, which was the world of this mistress of the arts oratory. His speech is contemptible. He did not look like one of the great orators. He did not sound like one of the great orators. Now, Paul, when he faced the Gentile world, was doing business with a generation, now listen to me, with a generation that was tuned in to the style of eloquence, dynamic public speaking in terms of artificial persuasions, but out of tune to content, logic, truth, ideas, divorced from foundational thinking. That is a world of words and dreams. Why? Well, we could wax philosophical about that, but you see, the wells of old pagan mythology and the wells of old classical philosophy had gone dry. One of the reasons that men in the first century of learning and men who found themselves speaking in public in the pagan world had to content themselves with words and to camouflage confusion with high-sounding words is that they had run out of good ideas. Paul did not meet that standard. So who responds in verses 2 through 5? And I like this. I like verse 2. It's kind of prophetically sarcastic, if you would accept that. I ask that when I am present, I may not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against some, regardless as if we walked according to the flesh. I'm asking God to keep me from lowering the boom the way I'd like to against this outfit. I mean, they're saying he's not an apostle because I didn't come in there and absolutely, very loud voice, throw my authority around, throw my apostolic weight around, and just line up everybody as they would have done it. I didn't overpower them with a storm of fancy language as they would have done it. But boy, I'd like to. And I ask God to help me so I don't. That's a good prayer, isn't it? Lord, help me keep my mouth shut. Listen, one of the finest elements in the art of legitimate biblical oratory is learning to keep your mouth shut. Paul asked for that. And then he continues in 2 chapter 2. Now the problem is, as I've already suggested, that they regard us as if we walked according to the flesh, as if we were one of them. But they were walking the flesh. I am a man. I'm not one of them. We do not war according to the flesh. For we are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we, that is we apostles, we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Now, what does that mean? When he says we are in the flesh, and we don't war according to the flesh, he is not posing some kind of dualistic transcendental knowledge as opposed to reason and dialogue and content. The flesh is not reason and content and objective truth versus a transcendental, mysterious, infused kind of knowledge. Rather, the flesh here is the cultural methodology of cheap substitutes. He's saying this, if I understand him. We are fighting empty speculations served up with cheap oratory. And we are not going to fight it with other empty speculations served up with more cheap oratory. They are saying I'm not an apostle because I did not use their methodology. And this is what flesh is. Flesh means worldliness, worldly standards, worldly values, and in this case, worldly methodology, the worldly approach. They say we do not sound like the rest of them. Therefore, we cannot be an apostle. I say to you, they have judged me by the wrong sense. They don't understand this, that world of artificial oratory is not the real world. What we are talking about when he says we use weapons which are divinely powerful, he is talking about devastating truth versus pagan nonsense. You got that? We are dealing with the real issues. He says we are at war. We are tearing down things, destroying fortresses of pagan darkness and error. We are destroying speculations. What do you think we're doing? We're not here with arguments. We're here to establish the truth. The contrast here is the massive content of the apostolic doctrine rather than the emotional appeal of the presentation. And that's what he relied upon. He said the same thing in 1 Corinthians 2:4. My message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and power. This is reality. He said if you're going to play games in the real world, play word games, you can be an orator. But if you're going to preach, it would be something else. Why? Because the world we're living in, Paul is saying, is the real world. People are committing real sins against the real God. They're going to go to a real hell. And Jesus died on a real cross. And we're not here to paint word pictures for the admiration of one another. See, the flesh can't do that. That's their business. Why? They have nothing but empty speculations, and we're coming against these speculations. Preachers, this is war. Orators can play games, and preachers cannot. We are at war. The Bible says so, and the enemy is not weak. We fight Satan in all of his disguises and fronts, whether it is communism, secular humanism, denominationalism, scientism, Catholicism, Protestantism, demonism, cultism, materialism, or plain old-fashioned American government-inspected, greater, undiluted, unadorned stupidity. Whatever we're fighting, it is all speculative. It is raised up, as he says, against the knowledge of God. It is based upon speculation. And our weapon is the truth. But if we do not know the truth, if we cannot comprehend, control with our minds the truth, the issues, the foundational knowledge, the real stuff, we will be fighting the speculations of the devil with speculations of our own. And we're going to lose, and we're losing it. Our brotherhood of the church is losing the battle. Because we are fighting empty speculations with our own empty speculations. Because we have raised up a generation of preachers who, for the most part, in my humble opinion, don't have the foggiest notion of what they're talking about most of the time when they ascend the pulpit. Why? They haven't paid the price. And listen, if we bring empty speculations against empty speculations, ours against the devil's, we're going to lose because he's forgotten more about speculating than we'll ever know. He's a pro. Paul says, what do you think we're doing here? They said, how can you say I'm not an apostle because I don't talk fancy? What do you think I was doing there? Well, this is war, he said. Well, this is the real world. This is war. The United States, by the way, is in grave danger because, in case you know, this is the first I get to politics. You see, we have fought the realities of communist aggression with empty rhetoric. The liberals have built a few dream fortresses for us, and now we have the theories and they have the bomb. We've got reams of high-sounding literature on the subject, but you can't defend yourself with paper and words. Not politically. Now, this is an analogy. This is war. The Church of Christ is in grave danger because we've been fighting the realities of hell with pop guns. Pulpit pop guns. Satan uses every powerful weapon in his infernal arsenal, and we flip rubber bands in his direction. I'm telling you, I don't mean to be unkind, but the average sermon that's preached in the average pulpit on the average Sunday doesn't have enough grit and gunpowder in it to scare the devil for 5 minutes. Well, the best it can do is keep the old ladies happy. Well, that happens. Stylish. Listen, we have the weapons. Divinely powerful, as he says, for the destruction of fortresses. We must master and use them. Stylish pulpit presentation, cute oratory, super personalities, preachers who are a little more than peddlers of pulpit pabulum, are holding their jobs but losing the battle. Time for unreality and appearances and ecclesiastical games has passed. Paul wasn't in that business, and we should not be. Now is the time for knowledge, for content, for teaching, for Bible, for caring, for courage, for bringing into our generation the devastating truth and sending it into battle against pagan nonsense in our day. People are going to hell, and it's time for the real thing. Paul says he wasn't impressed by that criticism. His speech was unimpressive, therefore it didn't mount anything. It didn't sound great. It was not according to the oratorical standards of his day. And he knew that that was an unreal world. By the way, this is in our tradition. The Restoration Movement was built on this kind of thing. Williams, in his life of Elder John Smith, tells about the time when Raccoon John Smith didn't trust Campbell. We had read after him and didn't know what to think of him. He went to hear him at Flemingsburg, went to meet him at Flemingsburg and hear him for the first time. This was the famous occasion when he heard him preach on the allegory of Hagar and Sarah. The building was filled, and Raccoon John Smith didn't want to miss a thing. He didn't have a great education, but he had a mind. And so he sat right down on the floor right under Campbell and looked up and listened. After the sermon, he said to his friend Elder Vaughn, "Is it not hard, Brother Bell, to ride 20 miles that I've done just to hear a man preach 20 minutes? You're mistaken, Brother John. Look at your watch. Should have been longer than that." He looked at his watch, and to his surprise, saw the discourse had been just 2 hours and a half. Holding up his watch, he remarked, "I have never been more deceived. 2 hours of my life are gone. I don't know how, though wide awake, too, all the time." Wasn't asleep. Did you find out, Brother John? Now ask Vaughn whether he's a Calvinist or an Arminian. "No," replied Smith. "I know nothing about the man, but be he saint or devil, he has thrown more light on that epistle and on the whole scriptures than I have received in all the sermons I have ever heard before." Listen, that's our tradition. Devastating content. Foundational knowledge. The real stuff. Here's a man who had been preaching for years, and it's what he's saying. I've learned more about the real thing. I've had the real article here more in this one sermon. And all the sermons I've had before. On his way to Mount Sterling, Brother Campbell, he said to Brother Campbell, they were riding along together back to where Raccoon John Smith was from. He said, "Brother Campbell, I've seen some of these preachers who were educated for the ministry in the Eastern colleges, and I was much surprised to find in you an entire want of gesture and manner." And their day, the style that day was very flamboyant, parading up and down the pulpit, and a lot of gesture, a lot of flowery language. He said, "I didn't see you do that." "Not much of a preacher, are you?" "No, I say that." "Well, he's wondering. Usually, you know, here came easily, well, somewhat awkwardly, and talked as common men talk. I never really studied all those arts of elocution of which you speak, Brother John," said Campbell, "but I have conscientiously refrained from any attempt to use them." Smith looked at him with a curious surprise. "The apostles," continued Mr. Campbell, "were sent forth as witnesses to a certain great fact. Suppose one of them should, in making his statement before the people, have plied his arms in gesticulations, stamped his foot in vehemence, and declared his testimony in the ears of the people with a loud, stentorian voice." Smith interrupted and said, "I would not have believed a word he said." You see, one of the reasons the Restoration Movement and the preaching of New Testament Christianity literally knocked the foundations out of a generation of denominationalism and infidelity was that it was led by a generation of preachers who forgot about the artificial oratorical trimmings and made sure that when they got up to preach, they were going to knock down some fortresses. They had some genuine ammunition. Paul said, "That's the way I operate." Listen, do not misunderstand me. Now hear me in this. That I am convinced that there is no class in this college which is more important than the homiletics class. In fact, I'd like to teach it once in a while. You'll get sick. But listen to me. And as Brother Glenn has taught you, we must learn the art of public communication. For this reason, Our fumbling mannerisms must not hide or distort what is in our mind and what must be said to the people. We do not study homiletics in order that we may hide the fact that there is nothing in our mind. And that is what first century oratory did. It hid the fact because it was so well said that nothing was being said. And when Paul refused to fit himself into that mold to meet their cultural expectations, he said, "I was not interested in hiding the fact that I didn't have anything to say, by the beautiful way I said it. I had something to say, and I said it, and I intended to get the job done. I was at war. It was not the theater, it was the battleground. We are tearing down fortresses. We are destroying speculations. We are undermining several millennia of pagan ignorance with the prophetic apostolic word." Now, that's all I said about that. This is the character of apostolic preaching. Preaching Christ in truth, substantive, foundational, objective, supported truth, as opposed to the unreal world of oratory. And we also learn this, the second thing I talked about, the character of the apostolic preacher. What is the character of apostolic preaching? Preaching Christ in truth. The character of the apostolic preacher is presenting Christ in person. There you have it. Very simply, apostolic preaching, Christ in truth. The apostolic preacher is to present Christ in person. He says, as we've suggested, verses 6 to 18, they didn't understand because they applied the wrong standard. They didn't know what business I was in. Now, he says, well, let me summarize these verses. I've already read them. He claims that charge, that he's one thing when he writes and something else when he speaks, that's false. Verse 11, "Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when absent, such persons we are also in deed when present." That's a false charge. Why did they think it different, though? What was there about his personal presence that set him off from Paul the author? Let me suggest that it's very hard to put love on paper. And when he wrote, they were rebuked and instruction and rude and cold print, but it wasn't the same when he was there. When he was face to face, his loving heart, his patience veiled his authority. He says in verse 6, "We are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete. We were criticized for not really using oratorical intimidation. We were criticized for not being authoritarian enough." He said, "Why not? We're ready to do that. I'm ready to come and really let you have it. Whenever your obedience is mature, give you a chance, let you grow up a little bit." You know, listen, there's a big difference between telling people and teaching people. And I learned from this. You get what he's saying? The time will come when I will really come there and hoe corn, cut out the weeds. But we'll give you a chance to go up first. I have said this before, I'll say it to you again. You fellas want to go out and preach, if you want to really skin the people, you really want to let them have it, if you want to lower the boom on them, fine. But you wait till you've earned the right to do that. You spend a few years living with them and loving with them and crying with them and teaching them, and then you've earned the right. You still want to do it. I'll do it, he said, but I'm going to let you go up a little bit. Verse 6. Look what he says. He says, we came to you to, verse 8, for even if I should boast somewhat, there's reluctantly further about our authority.